You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
I think you may know that the author of today's passage can sometimes come off as a little unhinged, if for no other reason than how routinely he mentions suffering, and not just mentioning it, but seeming to rejoice in it. What kind of a lunatic claims to rejoice in my suffering? What kind of recruiter is crazy enough to try and get you to join up with promises of hardship, vilification, rejection, and even death as rewards for joining up? And yet, here we've got Paul, along with later generations of martyrs, prophets, and activists, advocating for, essentially, the virtue of courage. In the chapter leading up to our passage today, Paul indulges in his most thorough explanation of Jesus' resurrection and all its benefits to us, and wraps up with basically saying, hey, get to work. Don't be afraid. If you're doing the work of healing the world, of transforming yourself, be confident. Throw yourself into it. You have the courage within you.
Our words of wisdom are from 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 58, the Message version.
With all this going for us, my dear, dear friends, stand your ground and don't hold back.
Throw yourselves into the work of the Master, confident that nothing you do for him is a waste of time or effort.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Most of you have heard me talk about the Midrash. It's a collection of rabbinic stories that expand on biblical stories that the rabbis thought were otherwise short on details. In his recent book, Quietly Courageous, Gil Rendell shares a midrashic story from the Exodus. It seems that when the Israelites got to the shore of the Red Sea, the waters lay before them unparted, and there was much anxiety. With the Egyptians bearing down on them from behind, they did what any profoundly religious group of people would do. They sat down at the water's edge and had a committee meeting, right? Who hasn't been at that meeting? How would you like to die? By drowning or by sword? Action was needed, and it was needed now. But the leaders were in vapor-locked paralysis. Enter Nahshon, son of Amminadab. Nahshon was a prince of the tribe of Judah and remembered the promise that had brought them to that moment. So he quietly got up and began to walk into the water, up to his ankles, and the water didn't part. Up to his waist, and the waters didn't part. Up to his shoulders, up to his chin, and the waters didn't part. And yet he continued. Then, as he took the step that would have put his nose under the water, the sea parted. No memorable words spoken. No persuasive arguments, no dramatic hero bringing attention to himself. Sorry, Charlton Heston. Just one person who quietly got up and did what needed to be done. As Rendell writes, while others argued about the right way to do things, quiet courage stepped up to fulfill the intended purpose of the moment. Look, comparing this story with the current depth of paralysis in our country is obvious, but from talking to many of you every day, it's also pretty applicable to most of our individual lives. Do we have what it takes? Courage to just get out of bed and face another day. Courage to pick up the phone, to call the person with whom you have a disagreement. Courage to be vulnerable and honest with those who could reject you. Courage to stand up to the hate and corruption we see everywhere we turn. Sooner or later, we are all faced with moments that demand courage. And when that moment comes, will we do the right thing? Look, if we lived in a world where the people who did the right thing always got the prize, nobody would need courage. If we lived in a paradise where nothing ever threatened us, we wouldn't need courage. But in the real world, we need courage because pain, loss, injustice, cruelty, and death are real. But here are two realities to keep in balance. And the first one is hard. When the moment comes, no one can decide for us. We have to do it alone. But the good news is, number two, community fosters courage. When you trust in your community or family to not reject you, when you trust that others will not let you down when crises or challenges come, and if that community is mature enough to have fostered the kind of spiritual preparation that is necessary for you to be confident in the kind of values that enhance human dignity and worth, then you never really are alone. Who can act courageously? Any living, breathing human being. Because the word courage comes from the Latin cor, which means heart, and the old French courage. Anyone with a heart to risk their current status and stability in order to pursue a greater good, to expose themselves to humiliation or the risk of their reputation or physical danger. The important thing is to have decided ahead of time that doing right is more important than what we may lose by doing it. Once upon a time, truth and falsehood met at a crossroads. After they'd greeted one another, falsehood asked truth how things were going. Truth said, "Well, each year is worse than the last." Glancing at truth's ragged clothes, falsehood said, "I can see the plight you're in. Even your breath stinks." Truth said, "Not a bite has passed my lips these 3 days. And wherever I go, I get troubles, not only for myself, but for the few who still love me. This is really no way to live." Falsehood said, "You only have yourself to blame. In fact, why don't you just come with me? You'll see better days, dress in fine clothes like mine, and eat plenty. But on one condition, you mustn't contradict anything I say." Considering that truth was so hungry that truth could hardly keep upright, he consented. "But just this once." They set out together and came to a great city, went into the best hotel, and sat among the beautiful people, eating food that was the best of the best. After many hours had gone by, most of the other people had gone. Falsehood rapped on the table with his fist, and because Falsehood was dressed like a great nobleman, the maitre d' himself came up to see to his wants. Falsehood exclaimed impatiently, "How much longer am I to wait for the change From the sovereign I gave the boy who sets the table. The maitre d' called the boy over, who said he had received no sovereign. Falsehood became angry and began to shout, saying he would never have believed that such a hotel would rob its customers, but would bear it in mind the next time. He then threw a sovereign at the maitre d' and said, "Here, bring me the change." Fearing that his restaurant would get a bad name, the maitre d' would not take the sovereign, but in fact gave change from the reputed sovereign of the argument and proceeded to box the ears of the boy who couldn't remember taking the coin. The boy began to cry and protest that he had not received a sovereign, but no one would believe him. "Alas," said the boy as he sighed and turned away, "where are you, unhappy truth? Are you no more?" Through clenched teeth, truth said quietly, "No, I'm here, but I had not eaten for 3 days, and now I may not speak. You must find the right of it by yourself. My tongue is tied." When they got outside, falsehood burst out laughing and said to truth, "Isn't it delicious to see how I orchestrate things?" Truth said, "Better I should die of hunger than to do the things you do." And they parted forever. Truth has been taking a beating in the world, hasn't it? In a world of alternative facts, reality seems to often be a moving target. But if anything is going to be done about it, it starts with us, with you, with me, and the courage within us. And it takes on many forms: living for a good cause, dying for a good cause, saying no to compromise, or saying yes to compromise, by throwing off your burden or bearing your burden. Yehuda Halevi, the great 12th century Jewish poet and philosopher, wrote, "To know of a terrible injustice is a tragedy, but to know of a tragedy and not speak of the horrific injustice is, in itself, a crime against humanity." And if saying something, doing something, all seems a bit too much, remember that even those who have changed the world know how hard it is to have the courage of one's convictions. Gandhi once said, "I have only 3 enemies. My favorite enemy, the most easily influenced for the better, is the British Empire. My second enemy, the Indian people, is far more difficult. But my most formidable opponent is a man named Mohandas K. Gandhi. With him, I seem to have very little influence." Listen to your heart. Embrace the values that you know to be true. Lean on your community, and then go for it. As Annie Dillard reminds us, you can't test courage cautiously. Back in 1989, I had the privilege of being chosen as a Rotary Paul Harris Graduate Fellow. I was accepted at Murdoch University in Western Australia and studied at Perth Theological Hall as an international ambassador for Rotary's 100 Club here in Phoenix. I had also applied to a seminary in Johannesburg, South Africa, but had to change plans. One of the things you have to do as a representative of Rotary is sign a covenant that says while you are in country, You are not allowed to voice any controversial political or religious ideas. Well, you might remember that 1989 was the height of apartheid, and there was no way that in good conscience I could go to South Africa without getting in trouble. In fact, the seminary I applied to was actively opposed to white supremacy and was being threatened by the racist government. So, needless to say, I ended up in Australia. But in one of my first weeks there, I was in an all-day orientation session with my class of 12 seminary students. Everything in Western Australia was much smaller in those days, along with two full-time professors, all of whom were guys. During the orientation, a part-time woman professor stopped in for a little bit to go over her role as the counselor for all of the students. As a trained therapist, she would oversee our psychological and spiritual well-being throughout the year. However, and I wasn't quite sure, but it seemed that from the moment she arrived, everyone in the room tensed up. I thought, this is strange. And then she started in on her overview about her expectations, intertwined with all these terrible generalizations about men and how hopeless this particular cohort of students was, and how from what she had learned about them in the previous year, they didn't have a clue of what real life was about, and she couldn't believe the threat that they posed to the church once they were out there as pastors, and blah, blah, blah. She went on and on, saying all these terrible things. And everybody, including the other professors, started to just sink down in their chairs. Now, I'm starting to think, hang on a second. While at the same time, I'm thinking about this document I signed that I could be deported if I caused trouble. But I also knew that if I didn't say something, I was going to have a stroke. Granted, I hadn't known all these people for long, but I recognized cruelty when I saw it, and this was downright abusive. Against every impulse of my rational mind, I raised my hand, and she called on me. To this day, I don't remember exactly what I said, but it was something along the lines of, I'm finding it hard to understand how you're going to be in charge of the well-being of all of us this year when you clearly don't like or respect anyone in this room. She looked at me like I have never been looked at before or since. She then burst into tears and ran out of the room. The lead professor looked around the room and said matter-of-factly, time for tea. A few minutes later, I was standing there nursing a cup of tea surrounded by all my new colleagues, and they were saying, oh, David, thank you so much. None of us could ever have said what you said. I mean, we have to live here, but you get to go back home to the other side of the planet, right? Oh my gosh, thank you for saying that. Meanwhile, I'm feeling terrible having made this woman cry, trying to figure out what crazy group dynamic I'd stumbled into, and having a growing certainty that I was definitely going to be deported. I felt such a burden of guilt that later that night, I looked up her phone number. As it turned out, her husband was the head priest, the canon rector, at the largest Anglican church in Perth. I'm thinking, oh no, I am deported for sure. Anyway, I called her up and said I just wanted to apologize. She interrupted me and said, no. What you said was really important and it needed to be said. And you need to hear me say that it wasn't so much what you said as the silence of those in the room who didn't disagree with you. So I'm resigning from my job. What? Well, the dust eventually settled, and later that year, she invited me to have coffee. I was a nervous wreck, but to my surprise, she was effusively thankful for that moment because, in fact, she had been miserable in that job and was thriving and happy in her new position. She thanked me again for having said what I said, and we laughed about how it had been a crisis moment for both of us. Friends, when the moment comes, do it. When you know it's right, even when you haven't fully thought through the consequences. But you do know one thing, that if you don't do it, if you don't say it, you will be less of a person. You need to do it. Maya Angelou wrote, "You develop courage by doing small things. Just as you wouldn't want to pick up 100-pound weight without preparing yourself. It starts right here. You have the courage within you. We have the courage within us. And as Paul reminds us, with all this going for us, my dear, dear friends, stand your ground and don't hold back. Throw yourselves into the work of the Master, confident that nothing you do for him is a waste of time or effort." Be well. Hey, if you liked what you heard today, buy me a copy. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.